Welcome back, folks. We are joined by Colonel Jeff McCausland, CBS military analyst, to talk about the Russia-Ukraine negotiation. Colonel, welcome to the show.
Newell, always a pleasure.
Colonel, I don't even know how to characterize this, but I guess the easiest way is to just say that President Trump seems to have backstroked off of what he had said before, that he was going to be able to reach some successful conclusion to this negotiation, but now he's out. And he says that Vladimir Putin is going to negotiate directly with the president of Ukraine, Zelensky. Your thoughts?
Well, you characterize it rather well, Newell. I mean, don't forget, Donald Trump ran for the presidency of the United States on a campaign saying that I can end this war in one day, and I may even end it before I enter the White House. Well, he's now been in the White House for, by my calculation, about 120 days, and we're no closer to ending this conflict than we were the day before he was elected. And as you say, quite rightfully, I think but now the president's saying, well, I'm just going to take my marble bag and go home. I'm done with this, and just walk away, which kind of, to me, suggests broader questions, which is we see ourselves as a major power and a leader of the free world, if not the world as a whole. Seems we were kind of abrogating, at least in this case, those responsibilities. Second of all, of course, this has an awful lot to do with the unity of the NATO alliance and the Biden administration. You can criticize them for it, and that would be fine. I think tried to pull NATO together in the aftermath of the Russian invasion and saw this as a point of unity, and even admitted two new members, Finland and Sweden, since this war has begun. And so now it seems to me, to a large degree, we're at least walking away from that commitment to NATO, if not walking away from our NATO commitments more broadly.
So what is the rub here? I mean, is it just attention deficit disorder, or I don't understand. I mean, you know, I know what the Russians are trying to do. They've done their manner of negotiation. I mean, if I can figure it out, I know you know well, you know, all the years you've been around this, what they do, they'll just drag this on. They'll get a concession here, a concession there, and then it'll go on forever.
Yeah, the Russians are great, and historically, not just Mr. Putin the last 25 years, about what I used to say. They're great at creating a problem and telling you that you've got to solve the problem they created, which is exactly what we have going on here. And I think what Mr. Trump may have not fully understood is from the very onset, Putin wanted victory, and Mr. Trump wanted a ceasefire. So they were moving in different directions from the very onset. And as a consequence, Putin determined that he always thought, and still does, to my mind, has the willpower to do this for as long as it takes to achieve that victory he wants so desperately. And eventually he thought Mr. Trump would either lose interest or lose willpower. And so far, at least, he has turned out to be correct. On Mr. Trump's side, I think he has had, and I can't understand it, Neil, this sort of, for lack of a better phrase, misguided belief that somehow he and Putin had this relationship as strong people, as major powers, that he likes Putin. He's never ever really criticized Putin any time, first term, this term, really. Don't forget, back in 2018, he met Putin in Helsinki and came out in a press conference and immediately repudiated all seven of the U.S. intelligence services because Mr. Trump said, well, Putin told me he didn't interfere in our elections, and I believe Putin, basically saying, I don't believe our intelligence service, I believe him. So that's one thing. And the second thing is, Mr. Trump has had this belief, I think, since he came into office this time, that there was this golden opportunity to establish great relations with Russians, and that would reap enormous economic bonanzas. And I'm sure Putin stoked that belief in the conversation they've had, because even in this case, Mr. Trump talked about the enormous economic opportunities that Russia could have with the United States if we could kind of get this war out of the way. And again, I never quite understood that, because to me, Russia is a declining power of about 140 million people whose economy is smaller than Italy's. And it's going in the opposite direction as the population ages. So how that was going to be a great economic engine for us while we, if you will, estrange our European allies who have about 400 million people and a GDP in total that's not too far distant from ours. So those are the drivers. And now, like I say, Mr. Trump says, I'm just going to walk away and you guys figure it out.
So this leaves Ukraine. I mean, can we honestly say that this is going to be a negotiation? I mean, from my perspective, I don't think it's going to be a negotiation. I think it's going to be a sit down, and there's going to be dictates that are going to be issued. And what does Zelensky do?
Well, the first thing, I'm fairly convinced, and I've talked to a lot of Ukrainians that I've known over the years, is they won't quit. Okay. I mean, I got to tell you, my read of the Ukrainians, if it came down to fighting with rocks, well, they might well do that. So Mr. Putin may think he's going to be successful in conquering this particular country, and who knows, he might well be. But I think the costs, even now, which are enormous, are going to be unbelievably enormous to do that, number one, and then maintain control of that population in the aftermath. I wish you all the luck, Mr. Putin, I guess. So they will not capitulate. They just won't, okay, number one. Number two, of course, the question is, what do our European allies do? And our European allies, most notably, we had the Prime Minister of Poland, we had the Prime Minister of Great Britain, the Chancellor of Germany, the President of France, all went to Kyiv on the 9th of May, anniversary of the end of World War II, to publicly pledge their solidarity with the Ukrainians. And subsequently, we've seen announcements about additional arms going from European countries to the Ukrainians. So the Europeans are going to try to see if they can, if you will, pick up the slack in terms of military assistance to Ukrainians. The Ukrainians also have their own indigenous defense industries, and they may still, it looks like Mr. Trump's willing to. He did a small sale or approved a small sale of F-16 parts to the Ukrainians a couple weeks ago, and may be willing to sell, I emphasize sell and not military aid, military equipment to Ukraine. In fact, the basis of this mineral deal that was signed up between Ukraine and the United States was that future provision of military assistance to Ukraine would be considered part of that overall investment. Whether that can be affected or not remains to be seen, because obviously no one's going to expand mining in Ukraine while this war is going on. But Mr. Putin believes he can be successful, and at the moment he's expending somewhere around 1,000 to 1,500 casualties every day. The Russians, for every square kilometer they capture, they suffer about 100 casualties. He is able so far, Putin, to recruit manpower to replace those people. Not much over that. He's kind of just recruiting enough to make up for his losses. And whether or not he can continue to do that and eventually grind the Ukrainians down remains to be seen.
So in light of everything that you just said, obviously this doesn't end anytime soon, and it really then becomes the wherewithal of the NATO alliance and how far down the road they're willing to go.
Yeah, exactly. I mean,
you know, and what happens to the relationship between them and the U.S.? I mean, we don't really know the bright line that Trump is going to draw, right?
Yeah, this to me is the ultimate question, because I firmly believe, and I've been only doing this stuff for about 50 years, that the objective of every Russian Soviet leader since 1949, their ultimate objective was always the same: destroy NATO. There may have been other things that we were doing, but those were means to that particular end. I think one reason why Mr. Putin wants to persevere in Ukraine is this whole issue of Ukraine now has become a wedge between the United States and the European allies. And the more he can press that particular point, I think moves him in that direction. Example, we're going to have a NATO summit at the very end of June, which ought to be an interesting event, to say the very least. The United States has already opposed an invitation that was going to be extended by the European allies to Mr. Zelensky to attend the NATO summit. Well, the Trump administration is blocking that particular invitation being extended to Zelensky. Furthermore, the United States, already in advance of that summit, has urged consideration about recreating something called the NATO-Russia Council, which was a bilateral meeting between Russia and the NATO members that had existed at Brussels pre-invasion of Ukraine as a place for dialogue between NATO and Russia. It was disbanded after the invasion, and Trump's calling for that to be resurrected. So it'll be a real question on how this affects the NATO alliance. And then last but not least, as far as negotiations go, Mr. Putin says, oh, he'll negotiate and the bilateral negotiations Trump has called for, but he wants to negotiate under what they call in Russia the Istanbul Protocol, which is their outline. And their outline goes like this. When Ukraine announces that it will never try to join NATO, when Ukraine announces that they're going to get rid of the Zelensky government and bring in a new government, when Ukraine announces that it will be neutral forever, not join any organization, when Ukraine reduces its army to 80,000 soldiers from about 1 million right now, when Ukraine agrees to accept Russian as an official language of Ukraine and change a bunch of names of cities back to their Russian names, when you do all those things, then we'll negotiate. But those are all preconditions to from the Russian side for a bilateral negotiation to end the war to begin. That sounds like surrender to me, and I just don't think the Ukrainians will do that.
Well, the only powerful tool that we really have is going to be U.S. sanctions on Russia,
right?
And without that, if you're removing that from the template, this is all for naught.
Well, that could be the wild card in the deck. I mean, we have two. One is military aid. Obviously, it doesn't appear we're going to do much of that. And the second, you're right, is sanctions. Now, Mr. Trump has repeatedly threatened if Putin's, as he says, if he's just tapping me, then he has threatened sanctions. But he's never delivered on those things. It doesn't look like he's going to deliver now. The Europeans have announced a 17th round of sanctions, particularly going after the so-called Russian shadow fleet, which is a means by which they bypass sanctions on oil to sell oil on world markets. Now, in the Senate, there's a bipartisan law being passed or been proposed to put much more significant sanctions on the Russians. So, again, it'll be interesting to watch if, in fact, that, and I emphasize bipartisan, I mean, people like Lindsey Graham from South Carolina support this. If that passes the Senate, then what does the Trump administration do? Do they veto that? Or do they simply say, well, you know, the Senate, they're not part of, they're out of control, you know, that, and that let that move along. And so sanctions, so-called secondary sanctions, will be very significant. But I think one thing that surprises me, this whole conversation, is the United States has already made significant concessions to the Russians since Mr. Trump became president, not going to be part of NATO. Ukraine has to give up territory. Mr. Trump publicly said he would accept de jure, I mean, public recognition that Crimea is officially part of the Russian Federation.
Yeah.
No other country in Europe would do that, okay? His Secretary of State passed a resolution in the Senate when he was still there forbidding any government in the United States to do just that. Entered these negotiations. Urged Mr. Putin to show up for discussions with Zelensky for a ceasefire. Putin didn't show up. Convinced Zelensky or forced Zelensky to publicly say he would accept a 30-day ceasefire. Mr. Putin rebuffed that. So we've already made a whole series of concessions and gotten nothing out of it. And now we've made the ultimate concession. We quit.
Yeah, I mean, if you would just, we have just about a minute or two left, but how important is signaling as it relates to this, you know, these diplomatic challenges that we have? Because it seems as though this president doesn't concern himself with that at all. I mean, and it's all over the map. There's no consistency. It doesn't seem to be a strategic plan here that dots are being connected, and we understand where we're actually going. We're all over the place.
Yeah, and it changes every minute. I mean, even the last couple of months, go to the disastrous meeting in February between Zelensky and Trump, and of course, relations between the two countries were at their absolute nadir. Then that seemed to come back, and Mr. Trump moved to being a bit more balanced, and we had the mineral deal with Ukraine. We had the meeting between Trump and Zelensky at the funeral for the Pope. And then we're moving to this, well, I'm going to walk away. So you're all over the place. And the signaling, as you suggest, is very important. Seems to me, as Americans, there are three reasons I always say that we think we should be involved in the war in Ukraine. First is a matter of morality. Okay, I fought in the Gulf War in command of the battalion. We didn't go to the Gulf War and liberate Kuwait because we wanted to make it the 51st state. We did it because the Iraqis invaded a small country called Kuwait, which was independent and sovereign, and killed an awful lot of people and basically persecuted the population. Kind of like what the Russians are doing right now. Yeah. I saw a film just yesterday. Russian soldiers executing. Yeah. But yeah, exactly. Executing Ukrainian soldiers who had surrendered. So a matter of morality. A second, a matter of values. We say we're on the side of democratic states and states that pursue individual liberty. Well, Ukraine is far from a perfect democracy. Neither are we, by the way. But they're a hell of a lot more a democracy than the Russian Federation ever is or ever was. And then last but not least,
or ever will
to
be.
Geopolitics. I mean, I always quote the Japanese prime minister who came to Kyiv a year or so ago, stood in the streets of Kyiv with Zelensky and said, if you want to deter the Chinese from aggression in the Indo-Pacific, meaning Taiwan, you have to stand up and win this war here. And I guarantee you the Chinese were watching this and saying, well, if the Americans aren't going to defend Ukraine, why in the world would they defend Taiwan?
Yeah. Yeah, this is, I don't know, I get this feeling that we're running amok right now, and it's not a good feeling. It's something that is mystifying to me, to say the least, and we'll continue to monitor this, and thank you so much for joining us and adding context to all of this, because there are a lot of different things that people don't realize that are going on, that are actually going on, and I kind of love the way that you just take it straight on and point out these unpleasant truths that we're facing and we're not dealing with on a daily basis, and it's going to be interesting to see where this ends. As always, thank you so much for joining us.
Sometimes truth is inconvenient.
Oh, yeah. More often than not. Colonel Jeff McCausland, CBS military analyst. Thank you so much, sir. Have a great week. We'll be right back. Stay with us.